So this afternoon, this evening, this morning, we have Jules who will be sharing for us on the second half of There Is a Solution. And Jules, you're okay to be recorded.
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Thank you. Take it away.
All right. Hello, everyone. It's good to see all the different people that I see in other food meetings. I feel like I'm at home. Thank you. For those who don't know me, my name is Jules, and I am a compulsive, obsessive person. And what brought me to 12-step was food. I played around with about 10 to 20 pounds most of my life. And I used food for ease and comfort. I had a really hard time staying abstinent. I was used to gaining and losing weight. As many people are. And let's see, came into BBA about 4 years ago, and I had some awakenings. It took a while for me to get my food all in order. That's God that got my food in order. And what helped me was two-way prayer and a fellowship like this one. And then I started investigating other things. One of them, and I'm involved in right now. In fact, I'm a homework person for moderating the homework for all addictions for chaos creating. I found out that I was creating chaos just about the same time I picked up food for ease and comfort. So I'll be talking about there is a solution from the lens of of me today as a chaos creator, adrenaline addict, controller fixer. Okay. In review, the first part of the book, or this chapter rather, which is There Is a Solution, which I love. There's a solution to all this. I've been hearing about, reading about the addiction, and okay, I'm ready for this solution. Let's hear it. So the big book helps me in this chapter to identify the problem, and the second half helps me to see what the solution is, and just bits of it as we will go through all the steps. For my emotional sobriety, my pattern may not be drinking or eating for ease and comfort anymore, but it's the rush of taking charge, the diagnosing of everyone. Trying to fix everybody, controlling the outcome, staying upset about that, or creating chaos so I can feel powerful, necessary, or alive, because that's where I got it from. I had lots of chaos in my background in my childhood, as many of us do. Wow, to be in charge when I was being, when people were trying to control me, my father for sure. I would turn around as the oldest of five and start controlling my brothers and sisters. I couldn't control me. I could control others, it seemed. So that adrenaline rush, that feeling of power, it's very interesting. I've done some research on all the things that the body creates. All kinds of drugs. It's like a little drugstore inside. I was getting a hit on being in control and trying to come in and see, oh, that needs fixing. I think I'll just fix that. No one asked me. So anyway, getting back to page 23 in the big book, and 24, kind of talking about the truths of what I'm here for, and that is to get the solution. What didn't work? Well, being in control didn't work. I could be in control for a little bit of everything, but not long lasting. There was always something that what the book talks about is that, what is it? this. Lost my place. This idea that I can stop if only I had more knowledge. And we find out that there's not enough knowledge to fix this, to fix our addictions, to fix our isms. And self-knowledge will never be enough. And the hardest truth that I can have is still a lack of power. I could say, I know this, I'll never do it again, I've learned my lesson, but self-knowledge says, hey, I'm controlling. And the obsession says, but this is necessary. And maybe the knowledge, my self-knowledge says, well, I'm over-functioning, and but my obsession says, but they need me. And my self-knowledge may tell me I'm creating chaos, but the obsession says, well, I'll just try to prevent a disaster. So the self-knowledge, just like the big book talks about with drinking and alcohol, is losing that power of choice. And I don't have a power of choice with this adrenaline piece, especially. The crisis, feeling of crisis, the adrenaline rush that I get from giving in to my addiction is that it gives me identity. The urgency makes me feel important. And the rescue role gives me a role to play. So, but afterwards, what happens to all of us is we feel depleted and resentful and disconnected from God. And that's not what I want. It's not what anyone wants here who wants to have spiritual awakening. So, the pages that precede the pages that I really want to talk about are I understand the problem, but I can't stop doing it. Knowing better doesn't mean you're going to be able to do better consistently. So, page 24 talks about, Chapter 7 talks about this mental twist, and that's what we use, this mental twist to think that we know enough. And by describing this mental condition, the person is able to then win out, and the willpower will take place. But it doesn't work, does it? So for me, it might sound like I can't manage this person anymore. I won't jump into the drama. I won't send that text. I won't fix what isn't mine. I won't rescue someone for the consequences of their choices. And then suddenly my mind gives me permission. Well, this time is different. They really need me. I need to step in. No one else is stepping in. Help me. All right, so here is the problem. And of course, next comes what is the solution? And the real solution is a spiritual awakening, of course. And that is talked about in on page 27. And it's with that conversation with Dr. Jung and the conversation with Roland Howard saying, and the doctor saying, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic, or for me, a chronic controller fixer. I've never seen one single case recover where the state of mind, and that's what we're talking about, is this state of mind that we come with as humans, that we rely on ourselves, and that perhaps there's another power available to us, says that. It says that where that state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you, you have this chronicness. So our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. So he told him he hadn't seen anyone really that with his kind of chronicness that could fix him. And of course, Rowan Howard said, well, geez, is there an exception? And of course, the doctor said, well, here and there, and once in a while, someone who is an addict will have a vital spiritual experience. And So what this really means, it's interesting. I was looking at Roland Howard, and he joined the after this confrontation with the doctor. Of course, he went to Europe to see the doctor, and then he came back and joined the Oxford group. And then, because of that, and getting religion of sorts, he ended up talking to Eddie, Evie, Ebby, and then Ebby talked to Bill. So this is a very incredible piece of information here that goes into the history. And so the doctor said, well, there are exceptions, and it's having this vital spiritual experience, which is the beginning of an inner change where I can stop living as I have been and go with a power that's available and much more powerful than I. And it talks about in this paragraph a huge emotional displacements. And I looked up how many times emotion was used or emotional in the big book. And it's only about three times. But what are emotional things? Fear, resentment, self-pity. These are all emotional things that we do without a spiritual experience to help us. Remorse, unworthiness, anxiety, selfishness, self-centeredness, restlessness, and of course, discontent. And so these are huge emotional displacements and arrangements that can only happen with a vital spiritual experience. And the doctor says, and which were the guiding, the ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these people, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and emotions begin to dominate them. So I love the way that's put, that it is an emotional rearrangement, because I really feel that that's what happens with emotional sobriety and the study of that. I mean, I look at the list that we go over each Sunday, and these are some of the things. I see my core addiction as this self-created ease and comfort.
Stella.
Is it 10 minutes?
Yeah, Jules, you now have eight.
Okay, thank you. Let's see. Being chronically late, overspending, controlling, fixing, saying no when I know I should. And giving advice, picking a fight, trying to control someone or something to get the outcome I desire, obsessing, projecting, taking things personally, obsessing with, or being obsessing with doing or being productive, judging or placing expectations, straight up lying by omission, being in my head all the time. So chemically or emotionally, and or emotionally, many of us, meaning me, I get a surge of adrenaline pumping through my body when I engage in these behaviors. So that's a sympathetic nervous system that kicks in when I am using controlling, fixing, and wanting that surge of adrenaline. So I need more insight than just, the promises that I tell myself to calm down. I need understanding. I need more than understanding my childhood. The fact that I grew up with such chaos and control in my life. So much control that I didn't want to even be controlled by 12-step organizations. So there is a phase, an emotional displacement that comes with having this vital spiritual experience. It comes with getting to know the God of my understanding, And I've been able to do that by having a practice of two-way prayer. Huge. I think I had, along with further study of the big book with BBA, the practice of a God of my understanding to have a very personal dialogue with, and being involved in a group that meets twice a week. That really helped with this emotional displacement and rearrangement that happens and ha is happening with me. But I can't ever rest on my laurels. I always have to be involved in my evening and morning practice. Evening, going over my day. When did I try to take control over a situation? When did I try to take God's place in what I do? When was I selfish, self-seeking? Do I owe someone an apology? Those things are in my practice to have this continual spiritual experience. And before my feet hit the ground, I must remind myself, as we're all, as many of us are going over the Thiebaud papers, Dr. Thiebaud, that this ego rises up during the night. It rises up. Here I was having a completely great rest, and I went over my day, and then in the morning, boom, it's like, what are we doing? Where are we going? What I'm, self-seeking, self. And so that prayer with God, God, what would you have me do today? What are the most important things that I need to do? Where can I be of service? And I can't be of service if I'm all about self or all about my chaos creating or all about controlling and fixing and obsessing and judging. So making room for God first thing in the morning is essential for me. So that ego gets in the place behind God, God first. So yeah, there is a solution, and it is that closeness to God, the closeness of being in fellowship with you all, to know that I can't share this with the rest of my friends. They aren't interested in a spiritual life. And it's great to be able to sit here and talk to you and listen to you and hear the same thing, the same human part of all of us that want to be more spiritual, more like God, and project God's protection, God's love, God's compassion. And it's such a privilege. And the more I think I overstudied on this today. There's so much to share about controlling and fixing and this all the different things that contribute to letting this go. And the reasons why it's hard to. It's in my DNA, it seems. The fact that I don't want to be controlled, and yet I need to be controlled by God. I need to let that go and let God control my heart and my wisdom and my compassion. So, yeah, I appreciate this topic, and now I'm ready to hear what it said for you. Thank you.